Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm always at a loss as to what to do at that point.
Well, I think we should give a disclaimer that exciting to us may not be exciting to anyone else.
I do not claim that exciting to you and exciting to me are the same thing.
We have now disclaimed.
That's a disclaim.
Yes.
And we could also disclose.
I think this could be an exiting program to anyone else.
Closing is what we do at the end of the show, right?
I'm not sure that I would say that we close anything.
Oh.
At the end of the program.
So disclosing is sort of like opening, isn't it?
Disclose is to open, yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
either that or you really don't like clothing.
Well, disclothe is different from disclose.
Well, maybe more than one set of cloth is clothes. So disclothes, yeah.
It would be discloth. Anyway, which is like disloth. Anyway, it tells you where our brains are.
Or not,
as the case may be. And this is Saturday, March 8th, in case you didn't know it. And if it is another day, then you can't call us. But if it is Saturday on the 8th day of March of 2014, then you're welcome to give us a call in here if you have any comments, thoughts, or just want to discuss or make weird noises about things to do with finance, investment portfolio management, and any of that other stuff, financial planning. The guy over here is the guy that's sitting over here in the plaid.
That would be Jake.
He's a certified investment management analyst.
Well, I hold that designation. That doesn't mean that that's what I am.
I think you are.
Just like you are.
He's a certified financial planner. And he really can talk about investments in a way that no rational human being can understand. Which means he's really smart, right? Basically working in the academic world now myself, writing papers, I have discovered that the secret to a good academic paper is if anybody other than other people who are at the same level you are can understand it, then you're going to fail.
Yes. You have to make it ununderstandable,
And then,
which is just standable, maybe?
Right. Standable. Yeah. And then this guy over here on this side who's wearing – the guy over there is wearing plaid.
Yeah. The old baldy across from plaid wearing Jake is –
Plain.
He wears plain.
Yeah, in the plain, the rains in Spain stay mainly in the plain. I am a guy who is certified as a financial planner. You like that? That's better.
You're certified. I think we're both certifiable.
We've both been certified. So if you have any questions about anything that falls into those two headings, investments or financial planning or anything like that, we probably can answer your question.
Even if the answer that we have is no.
Right. And we also need to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not merely the title of a radio program. It is also the name of a business, an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that has its registration with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which gives you a place to go complain if you don't like us.
Yes.
You can complain to the SEC. Yes.
If you would like to call in and ask us a question about
any of that stuff,
the numbers to call are
773-1400 if you're in East Bell County, or
1-866-597-1400
anywhere else in the sound of his voice.
Yes, he really likes it when I say that, which is why he says it so often.
I think it's really cool. Did you hear that?
Yes.
That was the dragon.
It sounded like a Klingon battleship approaching. That was a microphone pole being stretched.
I really like the sound effects that we can put in here. Anyway, as we said, the telephone numbers are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
So what are we going to talk about?
Well, let's see. We've got...
Stocks rise 1%. S&P reaches new high.
We've got Russian invasions. We've got... employment data. We've got...
S&P hit a new all-time high.
All-time high record for the S&P 500. We've got a lot to talk about this week. A lot to talk about this week. There's stuff going on all over the place. The Manufacturers Index report came out. I don't even want to begin the summary because the summary may take the whole program.
Manufacturers Index report.
Yep.
Yeah.
We've had expansion in every major report, which is just proof that we're not in a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you like to talk about first?
I don't know.
Let's just sing.
We could do that. Okay, the U.S. added 175,000 jobs. Then employment rose to 6.7%. Unemployment rose to 6.7% because employers across the country hired a whole bunch of people.
Well, even if you take the last several months' upward revision, what it amounts to is we had 200,000 new jobs.
Right, which is why unemployment rose.
Right. Huh?
You know, you're in this business and been in the economics business
doesn't
too long.
Doesn't even faze us.
If we hired a whole bunch of people, then we would have a higher unemployment rate. I know if you're listening to this, you're thinking, you guys' minds are weird. that's the truth. Because one of the things we say about investing and economics in general is it's generally counterintuitive. And there's a difference between unintuitive and counterintuitive in that whatever your gut reaction about the way things ought to be
probably not
is, the economic reality runs in the other direction. And that's so hard for people to understand. For example, one of the things that we talk about a lot is the necessity for government debt. The question is just how much of it we need to have, not whether we need to have government debt.
So the government
needs to have a lot of debt.
Yeah. Let's finish talking about the employment numbers and why they actually do make sense.
They do. Okay.
Oh, yes.
You can make sense out of this.
I can.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So let's say the private sector added 162,000 jobs. That's pretty good. The government sector added 13,000 new jobs, and that includes local as well as...
Those are net jobs, by the way.
Those are net jobs, yes. These are not fishing jobs, other kinds of net jobs. These are jobs after people were fired and laid off. These are the net result, extra jobs, 175,000. But then our unemployment rate ticked up. It went from 6.6 to 6.7. So you add 175,000 jobs, and unemployment goes up. A little bit weird, except that the labor force increased. This is something that you're not going to hear a lot of the political pundits talking about, because political pundits, particularly ones that speak on the radio, tend to have a conservative bent. Political pundits that are of the non-conservative bent have other things to talk about at the moment. So the labor force increased by 264,000 people. If you think back to when a lot of the political pundits were saying this is not a good thing that unemployment is dropping like this because people are leaving the labor force, that's the reason why unemployment is dropping. Well, they're coming back into the labor force now. That's what we're seeing. This is a really good sign. You have a thing to say, please. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true, what you just said, generally speaking. But this is one of those things that I looked at it and was instantly confused and still am. For the first time, let me quote from the Wall Street Journal here. For the first time in 46 months, more unemployed people found a job than dropped out of the workforce.
Right.
It's been 46 months, folks. November 2008. Was the last time that we had more people being hired than we had people dropping out of the workforce. So what you said is correct. The issue is that there are people re-entering the workforce at this point.
People that just gave up on looking for jobs, just said, I'm not even going to try anymore, are coming back and saying, hey, people are getting jobs now. That's what's going on.
And the other thing that I think is significant is that in February, when we had really nasty weather, the construction industry added net 15,000 jobs. And in January, they added 50,000 jobs. And this is one of those things that if you want to be pessimistic about the future, really can mess with your mind. Because when the construction industry is hiring at 50,000 people a month, the economy is going to see some big positive effects over the next year because of the ripple effect. We, you know, it's really hard to know what a construction, what all the construction companies are actually doing because they have a tendency to keep it kind of quiet. For some reason or other, they don't want their competitors to know everything they're doing.
Speak
I can't imagine
yourself,
why.
For yourself, if you try to sleep through a construction site, they don't keep it quiet
but
at all.
But they in advance. And so when they're hiring a lot of people, that is reported. And they hire people before they build things, generally speaking. And when they build things, they buy a lot of stuff, which is a technical economic term.
Yes, we talk about stuff often, and we rarely give a definition of the word stuff. You're just going to have to bear with us on that.
Bear?
One.
Yeah, we have a dog that has a stuffed bear.
Yes.
And it tore it open, and inside of it we could see the stuff.
Stuff. There is stuff in there.
Right. Yeah. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Longtime listener. I've been reading a lot in a lot of different resources, and they all say that investors are starting to get back into the market. I know you're not supposed to time the market, but haven't they already kind of missed the boat? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Have they missed the boat?
Well, that depends on the boat, and I think of the market more as a bridge.
When I'm missing the bridge.
You could miss the bridge. That happens. People drive off the bridge
often. You have to go back to Chappaquiddick to get the real effect on that one, though.
But the reality is that timing the market and trying to say if you've missed the boat, you should be...
You're mixing metaphors very nicely there.
If you're investing and you have a long-term perspective, you're looking way out into the future... Whether or not you missed the upturn in the market since 2008 or even from 2011 or even this year, any of those periods you could have missed. But if you think that the American economy is going to go away tomorrow, then you've missed the boat.
And
if you think it's going to continue to do well, then you're on the bridge.
As far as missing the boat is concerned, no, they missed the boat a long time ago. And if they're going to get back on the new boat...
They're probably going to get off at the wrong time, too.
The key is to stay. And the people who are getting back into the market, when you consider that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, let's see, the Dow was at 667, as I recall, or 676 at the bottom of the market. And now it's at, where is it? No, I'm sorry. Got my numbers wrong here. The S&P 500 was at 676 at the bottom of the market, and obviously it's a heck of a lot higher today. It is well over doubled since the bottom of the market in 2009. And people getting in right now, generally speaking, are the people who got out at the bottom. And it's not the getting in right now that's the error. Getting in right now, by the way, I think is a great idea if you're going to stay in. Now, on the other hand, if they're going to get in and ride it up and then ride it down and enjoy the upside to the market and then once it goes down, get back out again, there's a lot of studies out there, particularly one, there's an ongoing study by a company called Dalbar.
It's called the Quantitative Analysis of Investor Behavior.
Yes. I love that. Anyway, the quantitative analysis of investor behavior.
I just call it
QAIB.
QAIB.
Discovered that during the bull market of the 1990s, the average investor, the average individual investor, managed to lose money, which takes a phenomenal effort. But the bottom line is a good asset allocation. Every study everybody who has seriously looked at this over the long term and is not working off their intuitive gut feeling, just like I said earlier, that's going to take you backwards, says you have a good allocation, you stick with it over a long period of time, you will do well. If you decide that you're smarter than the other 10 gazillion people who are trying to time the market, unless you really, really are, actually, even if you really, really are, you're still going to lose. The only people so far who we've seen who really can consistently beat the market that are not professionals, surrounded with lots of money to do investigative work and lots of people working for them to research things, they tend to do a little better. But everybody else who tries this has a different name, and it's called loser, or if they're successful, they're called prisoners.
Right.
Inmates. Criminals.
Yeah. Dalbar's study, basically, I'm going to give some summaries. I'm not going to give, because they update this study every quarter, so it's one that's been going for a long time. Basically, they're showing that long-term, the S&P 500 has done fairly well. It's pretty amazing. And that funds whose managers invest primarily in the S&P 500 tend to do better than the S&P 500. Okay, so far, so good. Investors who in the funds that are investing in the S&P 500, again, these funds have done better than the S&P 500, do far, far worse. As in like 5%. If the S&P 500 is up over a long period of time, 12%, they get 2%. And that is significant. These investors, and Dalbar keeps coming back, the reason why they do so poorly is because they tend to get out when the mutual funds are not doing well and get back in when the mutual funds are doing well. That's a problem, folks. That's called buy high and sell low. That's the opposite of what we should be doing. But human behavior says that we're going to keep doing that unless we consciously decide not to. And that analysis, the caller said, missing the boat. It's really a consistent missing of the boat. If you get on this boat, and I'm mixing it back to boat, bridge, or whatever, and you just stay on the boat, even if it's a semi-mediocre fund, and you stay there for a long period of time, you're likely to do fairly well. Long-term sticking to things, as long as you've done some research to begin with, as long as you stick to being involved, you can wind up doing fairly well in the market. It's the people that try to be smarter than the market, the people that try to say, I'm getting out now or I'm getting in now, and timing when that is, it's impossible. You can't do it, or if you can, you just lose a lot of money. Anyway, that's my summary of an answer. If it was long-winded, then that's because of the program that you called.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. There's a really have a lot to do with failure, economically at least, in our society. Actually, more than economically. And that is that if we don't do long-term planning and we don't think over the long term, we're going to tend to do poorly. There are, again, lots of studies, lots of research has been done on this, and it was backed up, if you'll think about it, by your own personal experience. The people who have a longer planning time horizon tend to do far better than the people who have the short time horizon. A short time horizon would indicate that if a newspaper headline comes out, says market crash, people lose billions of dollars or whatever, and you panic and jump out of the market, obviously your time horizon is today. On the other hand, if your time horizon is really long-term and you look at the long-term history and probable future of the values in the various indices or indexes in the market, and you realize that that point when the market is down and people have, quote, lost billions of dollars in the market, end quote, by definition, the market's cheap. By definition, the further down the stock market goes, the greater the gains will be over the next decade or two. And so people with a short time horizon are looking at right now and making long-term decisions. Whereas people with a longer time horizon kind of get excited when the market goes down. I really like it in some ways when the market goes down. I really like it because if people are investing money, or we can find bargains a lot of times for invested money when the market is down. I don't like it because I know I'm probably going to have to deal with a lot of negative emotion from people who are afraid. And the fear, unfortunately, is the greatest among people that when I talk to them on the phone, I hear the television going in the background. And I can tell you that the more you watch the news on the any news channel, whether it be any, I don't care which one you watch, the longer you watch it, the less rational you're going to be about the way things really work. And yeah. I know that sounds today in this society, you might as well go to vaudeville if you were in the if you're in the early 1900s. You might as well go to a vaudeville show and try to understand what's going on in the real world.
Right. It's kind of to use the analogy of the antelope herd. There was a time when we, and I'm using this analogy as being the humans are the antelopes, we're all standing out in the field, and if somebody raised their head and snorted, it meant that there was a lion approaching. Well, now we have people raising their head and snorting about lions on other continents, and we're all just as afraid as if they're right here with us.
Right, and the problem is that some of the antelopes who are snorting are working for the lions.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I know that most of our clients, at least most of the ones that I talk to, pretty much try to watch Fox 24/7. Man, folks, all I got to say is let's put it like this. The Fox, when you turn on Fox, they don't charge you by the hour for watching Fox. It's free. And anything that you get that has anything to do with the economy or financial that somebody tells you is free means you're paying a price so high
somewhere
that if you knew how much you were paying, you would scream and run in the other direction. And that's just the reality of the way finance works, investments work.
Now, I've got to say this. Fox has got a great business model. Rupert Murdoch's corporation, the whole thing, has this wonderful business model.
Absolutely.
That is extremely profitable. From an economics point of view, he's doing everything right.
Right.
If you're getting your information solely from one source, then you're buying into his profits.
Well, you're
I'm not saying that he's wrong. Please don't get me wrong there. He's an entertainer. That's what news is.
And right now, it's very entertaining for people to be afraid.
Yes. Well, that's how you sell news.
Yeah.
You sell news by scaring people. We're hardwired to listen for things that are bad. We need to make sure that we don't have the bad thing happen to us. This is a good thing, not a bad thing.
And a little disclosure here, I don't watch Fox except on rare occasions. So I'm really not in a position where I can carefully criticize what they're doing. All I know is the number of telephone calls and emails that I get from people who have watched Fox, and they tell me their impression of what they just heard or saw. And when I go look at the facts and send them back, they don't match up particularly well.
All right, so I'm going to change the subject just a little bit.
Okay.
And it has to do, the trade deficit is $3 billion a month smaller than what it was a year ago. And I can give the actual numbers on that, but numbers, anytime you say billions of dollars, they become meaningless anyway.
Well, a billion here, a billion there.
Right. Pretty
soon you're talking about some real money.
The clearest implication that I can give, though, was that in January of 2006, and we've got January numbers for 2014 now. January of 2006, we in the United States imported 12.5 times as much petroleum as we exported.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. We were bringing it in at high volume.
Mm-hmm.
And the high volume is measured in trillions of cubic feet. That, if billions are incomprehensible, I don't even want to try with the trillions of cubic. I have trouble trying to figure out.
We're not talking about barrels. We're talking about.
No, when it comes to natural gas, okay, it's in cubic feet. And when it comes to oil, sometimes it's in barrels. But we're trying to come to one big consensus of cubic feet is now what we're using. And when I'm ordering dirt for my yard.
Right.
Trying to calculate 9 cubic feet and how much actual dirt that is, it becomes very difficult.
Well, it's obviously a cube. 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet.
Right. 9 cubic feet. But how many is that in square feet? Well, you don't
depends
have square feet. You can't do that.
No,
square
it depends
feet.
On how deep it is, right?
So what I'm saying here is that in 2006, we're going to use numbers that we can all understand. We were importing 12.5 times as much as we were exporting as far as petroleum products. That's gas and everything else. So we can see 12.5 is more than one.
I like that.
this is easy stuff.
This is higher math.
High math. So please stay with me. Okay. This year in January, petroleum product imports were 2.5 times exports. 1 to 2.5 versus 1 to 12.5, and projecting into the future is very easy because we know the reserves that have recently been discovered and the ease at which we can get to them. Within 4 years, we will be a net exporter of all petroleum products.
Except that it's illegal to do so.
Not necessarily.
It's illegal to export oil.
Not necessarily.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's illegal to export oil without a signature of the Secretary of Energy to any country that does not have a free trade agreement with the United States.
I thought, well, wait a minute. I may
free
be
trade,
wrong.
There's
no,
only
no,
a few.
Be,
there's
I
only a few
wrong.
Places. We export oil to Canada. We export oil to Mexico. There's a lot of places that we can export oil.
Export oil to two places that export oil to us. That's
yes,
interesting.
And,
yes,
and it's funny if you look at the graph of how that happens. We export oil to Mexico as they're importing oil to us, and we actually export more oil to Mexico than they send to us, but it's just this weird
got it.
Circular
makes
weirdness.
Perfectly
there's
good
some
sense.
Really good graphs that I could show you on that. But the reality
not
here,
on the radio.
Not on the yeah. Well, I'll show you. Just you'll follow the arrow here and goes and yes. Anyway, very pretty colored graphs for all you listeners out there. We can export oil. We can export natural
but
gas, but
we
only
can export, for instance, to Europe.
No, not unless we either have a signature from the Secretary of Energy saying it's okay to do so, and that's a really long process, or they become a no-tariff state. We do free trade completely with them.
The
Singapore is another place that we do this with.
I know that the Speaker of the House was talking about redesigning the 1973, I think it was, law that forbade us to export oil.
Right.
And
because we were concerned about being energy independent.
And gas, for example, we're not supposed to export natural gas either, but that doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, we actually have one natural gas export location with two more being built and a third or a fourth being planned. And in the stage, we should actually have four full ports that export large volumes to tankers. But each of those has to be approved unless it's going directly to a free trade
country. Like I said, we passed a law in the 1970s during the oil embargo, said we had to leave because the price of oil went up all over the world, and there was a tendency for the free market to actually work here and
what?
People to send the oil where the price was the highest.
That's amazing.
And Congress blocked it, and they have refused to remove that block. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I turned the lights. I'm not sure if you've talked about this, but it seems like within 36 to 48 hours after Russia, you know, sent those troops into Ukraine, the ruble crashed. And could you kind of explain that in as simple terms as you can and what events happened to lead to that crash?
Yes.
The crash. Thanks.
Okay.
This
thank
is
you.
A good subject. I didn't hear.
Did you hear the crash?
I heard it. It was the sound of a feather fall.
Okay, got it.
Let me begin with saying that there is a very serious crisis going on in Ukraine. It is one that can affect the economy, and that long term may lead to war. It may lead to no war. There's a lot of uncertainty there. The reason why the ruble crashed, and you said keep it simple. We've got more stuff we can talk about soon, but I'm going to keep it simple. We've got to play some commercials in a moment. We will be talking more about Russia. The GDP of Russia is roughly equivalent to Texas. Russia cannot fight a long-term war with the continent of Europe and the United States. With the rest of the world ranged against it, it cannot hope to win. Nukes exist, so that's the uncertainty. What Putin is doing is saying, you're not going to do anything about it because you didn't do it in Georgia for the two provinces, one of which is we know the name and one most people have never heard of. So why should you do it now? The reason why the ruble crashed, the reason why the Bitcoin has skyrocketed in the middle of bankruptcy proceedings for the major exchange, and the reason why and robberies and hacking and so on, is because the citizens of Russia are dumping rubles on the open market. The oligarchs, the billionaires, are saying, how do I get my assets somewhere where it can't be seized by the international community? So the ruble fell because people were selling rubles and buying dollars, and they were buying bitcoins, and they were buying anything that wasn't a ruble, because targeted sanctions on individuals is where it starts. That's already begun, which means that if the main shareholders of Gazprom, which is the state-owned but also privately owned gas production company that is pumping gas into Europe and into Ukraine, if they cut off gas, as they have threatened to do, then the sanctions are going to be applied to them directly, the people involved there. It's going to hurt Russia as much as it hurts anybody else. So this is one of those things. Brinksmanship is there. The reason why the ruble crashed is because a lot of Russians were selling rubles. That's an easy answer. So we can go into a lot more detail, but we've got commercial.
If you actually pronounce that a little differently, it would probably be an accurate statement.
What's that?
Rubble.
Rubble?
Yes.
Rubble.
When you use rubble as your currency, you're going to be in for some difficulty.
Right. And we can go. We do want to speak more about this because it really is a crisis. It is a crisis that's kind of running below the level that even Fox News really wants to talk about. It's a crisis that long-term will mean very little, but it's a crisis that short-term has some need for
screening. Anyway, you're right. We do have to do commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Give us a call here to stimulate our brains and get us to do something that's interesting. You can give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back after these important words from KTM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Did anybody besides me notice a pattern to those commercials? I mean, you should call me, what was it, the something of joy?
The messenger of joy.
The messenger of joy.
And then,
if you're feeling really terrible and you think you're about committing suicide,
and you got,
file for bankruptcy immediately.
Divorce. IRS problems.
You have IRS problems? We can reduce your IRS problems to the point where a mere bankruptcy will get you out, and then you can get a divorce. I need to ask Ed if he gives discounts for people who get bankruptcy.
Buy one, get one free.
You get do both at the same time.
If I get two divorces, can I get my price down? That's the question.
Well, if you get two, for every two divorces, you get a free bankruptcy.
Oh, there you go.
And I think it might be appropriate, you know. Which makes me think that maybe we're on the wrong radio station.
It should be. Or maybe we're really on the right one.
Well,
I don't know.
You know, I mean, we're in the business of investing money, and that means people have to have some money.
Well, yeah, but we're on here educating people on how to improve their own investment practices.
Well,
hopefully.
if all they have is debts and IRA, anyway, it's really. I thought that was an interesting little brace of commercials there. I think commercials should come in braces. There is a little bit of news out there.
Orthodontics.
It's one of those little things that comes up that I think is really significant that very few other people pay much attention to. The headline, the Wall Street Journal, is top Democrat firmly backs Fisher for Fed vice chair, which means that Fisher will be in charge of all the vice at the Fed.
Oh, yes, all the vice at the Fed.
And
I don't think anybody doubts that Fisher will be winding up.
But, you know, that's one of those things that we don't pay a lot of attention to, but our senators are the people who make the decision, and they have some degree of response to us.
They don't make a decision. They just review the decision.
Well, they can either approve or disapprove.
Right. Advise and consent.
I would hope that our senators will make rational decisions because, you know, this is...
It's really hard not to in this particular case. The guy was in charge of the economy of Israel. Which did really, really, really well during the downturn.
But Stanley Fisher, now that's one of the things that is interesting. When you have the person who is the deputy chair, vice chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, who, when you consider that the chairman or chairperson in this case of the Federal Reserve is arguably, from an economics point of view, the most powerful person in the country.
Correct. Or in the world, for that matter.
And you have a person who is, if she were to suddenly have a heart attack, who would take over, who is a citizen of Israel as well as the United States.
Citizen of the United States. Yeah, so, that could have some implications abroad.
What do you think about the issues of, you know, there could be some people object to this. And if people paid much of attention to it, I think a lot of people would object to it. But the point is, this guy is good. He recognizes, and if by approving him, the Senate will, I think, it'll be fascinating to me to watch who votes against him, will be recognizing something that is so critically important, and that is that economics is global. There was a time when our economy, we thought at least, our economy was just our economy, and we could survive alone in the world. It's called isolationism, and it is starting to creep back into our thought process.
Oh, that's what the whole Paul family, the Rand Paul, Ron Paul family thinks is the necessary way to go.
The fact is, we are in very much a global system, and we're not coming out of it.
We can't come out of it. Our interests, our trade, our monetary everything is part of that. We were just talking about petroleum exports, imports, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we buy from? And if we want to be a net exporter of oil, who do we sell to?
And
if we're not involved in that in a global way, then
you know
we're going to be dependent on somebody forever.
And one of the reasons that we are the most successful economy in the world right now, and we are by far.
Yes.
The most successful economy in the world, is because of things like the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, if you recall, Ross Perot, the conservative libertarian,
said, don't do it.
Giant sucking sound. Yeah. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Change subject just a little bit. Approximately 3-4 years ago, you engaged in a discussion about a subject, should one consider filing for early retirement with Social Security at age 62?
Mm-hmm.
And you were discussing the benefits and the disadvantages. I was curious. At that time, sadly, I didn't pay enough attention. Today, I would pay much, much greater attention to your discussion.
I bet it's because you were younger several years ago than you are today.
I love the way this guy can grasp the obvious.
I'm brilliant, I tell you, brilliant.
Well, it's, you know, not much has changed in my opinion, but there's more than one opinion here.
Yeah, and it really is different for every person involved. In your case, if you continue to work after you begin taking Social Security, just know at age 62, for every $2 that you make in your employment, you're going to lose $1 of your Social Security benefit.
And one of the things, it really, you're making a bet here. And the issue is, how long are you going to live, and are you married? Are you married, by the way?
No.
Okay. Okay. Well, then it does make a lot of difference.
Very much so.
Because if you're a male and you're married, for the joint well-being of you and your wife, presuming your wife's in good health and you're in reasonably good health, the later you wait to draw your Social Security, the better off you wind up being.
And this is different for you, though.
The opposite is true if you're just talking about yourself.
And here's another weird one.
Right.
If, as the secondary earner, and rather than saying male versus female, the secondary earner in the family, sometimes it's better for the secondary earner to retire early,
yeah,
and get the spousal benefits, which is half of that spouse's benefit, going to the main earner, regardless of whether they're working or not. So there's some weird, mm-hmm, this is not a simple question.
Well, it really comes down to, there's a very simple guideline I give people. When you are ready to retire, it's a good time to start drawing Social Security.
Yeah,
and
that's absolutely the case.
If you hit what's called your FRA, which used to be full retirement age. It's either full or federal, and they've changed the name back and forth. Someplace.
It's just FRA.
Okay, FRA. The FRA, which is either, I think it's the full retirement. Yeah, it used to be federal retirement age. Now it's full retirement age. That is sort of, for most people, the ideal, because you can, prior to your full retirement age, which depends on when you're born, if you're about to hit it now, it's probably 66. If you retire before that and start drawing Social Security before that, and you make any earned income of any significance at all, they're going to reduce your Social Security. And the problem is that reduction sort of stays in place. You're going to have a relatively low payout for a long time. Once you hit your full retirement age, you can work, and they don't cut your Social Security. You may have to pay taxes on it, but that it isn't formally cut.
You only pay taxes on 85% of it. So
right.
There's, like I said, or he said, and we said together, this is not a relatively simple answer. What I would say...
That's what he said.
What I would say here is that if you have the ability to put together an Excel spreadsheet, a relatively simple one, and you have the ability to recognize that there are 12 months in a year, and there are a certain number of years between early retirement and full retirement, you can start putting the math together. If you're getting, and I'm going to use, rather than asking you specifics, I'm going to use some random numbers, not truly random because they're based in the realm of reason, but if you get $1,000 a month for retiring at age 62, but if you waited till your full retirement age, which for some people is 66, some people is 67, and at that age you get $1,200 or $1,500, then it's really, I could tell that without doing any math, it would be better to retire early. But a really quick way of doing that is you multiply that $1,000 times 12 months times the number of years till your retirement, and you look at how much money that is. And it's going to be, if you've got $1,000 and it's going to be 5 years till full retirement, then that's $60,000. How many months would it take that increase that you get at full retirement? If you're getting $1,200 instead of $1,000, you're getting $200 more. How many months of $200 more would it take to pay back that $60,000? Because you're making money between now and full retirement if you take it now. How many months would it take to earn that back? Well, at $200 a month, it would take a very long time. So that's an easy answer. But the real question is, are you ready to stop working?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be one that I could ask you, caller. Are you ready to stop working at age 62?
No.
Okay. Well, then
don't draw your Social Security
draw it
at
yet.
62.
That's an easy one.
Because you'll basically draw it and lose it. But your long-term, once you do retire, your long-term benefit will be reduced because you signed up to take it early, and you lose under those circumstances. And people that I have known who really, very frankly, don't need their Social Security, And they retire at 60 or whatever. In many cases, they start drawing at 62. And that's not a particularly bad idea because they're not working anymore.
Yeah, it's not hurting them at all to take that.
So there's a lot of variables in this question. But the bottom line to it is, if Social Security will be significant to you and you don't want to quit work, wait until your full retirement age.
Yeah, and that there's a separate issue here. If you do reach full retirement and you're wondering about whether or not you should wait till later, if you're about to reach it, sometimes, and this is a large number of times, it's better to take it even though you're still working. Other times, it's better to wait. And this comes back to that same spreadsheet. You need to do the calculations yourself. And the other question is, what are you going to do with the Social Security money? At full retirement, it isn't canceled out by your current employment. If you do something with that money that gets a return, you may wind up making a lot more money off of it than otherwise.
That's one of the things that the complexities that add in here. If you're working and you're making money and you're living comfortably on the money and you turn age 66 and you say, should I start drawing my Social Security because I really don't want to quit until I'm 70, probably a good idea. Draw the Social Security and invest it. And don't spend it, invest it. And you'll be far better off once you do retire.
Yeah.
And we're about out of time.
Well, thanks for the call. Hopefully we didn't completely confuse the matter.
Sure, we
muddled the water.
It.
It's what we do.
Annuities and Social Security is an annuity are pretty complex things. Okay, thanks for calling.
If you would like to talk to us off the air, we've got another hour after this that we will be talking about all kinds of world events and such. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111. That's a really hard number to remember, 947-1111.
We also have a toll-free number, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts or send us messages through the page if you do listen to the podcast.
Just read all the stuff that's on there. You can read our form ADV.
It's true. I would advise, for sanity's sake, to seek therapeutic counseling before and after. But
if you have trouble sleeping, our form ADV makes really, really
put
good,
you right to sleep.
Good sleeping material. We wrote it, and it's really good for
sleeping. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.